Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie of RM Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench.
Hey Matt, what are you wearing? That's a snazzy t-shirt.
Well, Rob, I'm wearing the brand new Fighting on Film t-shirt. It's available now at fightingonfilm.com in our merchandise shop, and it features Fighting on Film, the war movie podcast, inside a beautifully designed film reel frame.
Amazing. And they are available at fightingonfilm.com?
They are indeed. Celebrating our 150th show, you know.
And speaking of 150th shows, let's get on with it.
Hello, and welcome back to Fighting on Film. Now, we've talked about it over the last couple of weeks, but this is in fact our 150th
Woohoo!
Episode of Fighting on Film.
Woohoo!
And to commemorate this, we are doing a big one. We are, of course, covering The Guns of Navarone.
Yeah, what a classic. What a proper, like, dyed-in-the-wool classic to do. You know, we were racking our brains for a few weeks thinking, oh, what should we do with 150th? Should we be funny and do like a really obscure thing, or like, you know, try and get a big guest on maybe and do it? But we thought, no,
clip show.
I had this idea, and if you're at We Have Ways Fest, I might have run it by a few people, and they looked at me like I was insane. I was like, I was going to do a clip show of things we hadn't actually done, like a fake clip show, and like get AI voices and have like, you know, on. We spoke to Steven Spielberg and it'd be like, you know, an AI Spielberg, but I just thought that wouldn't work and only about three or four people would get it.
Yeah, it's too meta.
Too meta. So we kiboshed that. And yeah, I mean, Guns of Navarone, you can't go wrong. But before we jump off on that one, because there's a lot to get into, just wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, some of our favorite moments of the show so far, like memories that we've got that we really hold on to. Matt, what about you?
There's so many. I mean, it's 150 episodes. It's really hard to pick out. And at the same time, a lot of the time, I often forget we've done certain films.
Same.
And I go, oh, that'd be a great one to cover. And then I realize we have actually done it.
And the amount of times we do that is crazy. For me, it's the amount of like industry guests we've had and some of those great interviews, you know, like Dale Dye. I mean, getting him on, yeah, chatting to him.
Dale on was amazing.
You know, Before You Die type
and
stuff.
Jim Dowdle as well. Jim, that was incredible.
Jim Dowdle, like learning how he drove that burning Marder in Saving Private Ryan. Just incredible, you know, and Charles Maynes, when we went through the how you do sound effects and foley work, like amazing. You know, Tom Petsch for The Patrol, having a director on, talking about their own films is such a treat. There's just so much.
the Attenborough's private army guys. Boys, they were fantastic. The
amount of people that still talk to me about that show, not to cat out of the bag early, but maybe next year we'll have a little extra thing with one of them chaps if we can get it off the ground. Some great moments as well, and some great moments that we've like done and some phrases that we've coined. Like to me, I always remember the Wind Talkers episode where you say the director shat his pants all over the film. Just so good.
Oh my god.
And then last week's Rat-a-tat-tat Gatling gun quote.
The rat-a-tat-tat.
If you've not listened to that, go back and listen to it, because it was so funny.
I'm sure there'll be more of that today.
Maybe.
No, but we've done some really interesting films, you know, like The Hill, The Heroes of PT-216. There's some real
gash out there. There really is.
Deep, great films of the genre, Rob, as well as absolute.
Dirty Dozen December that nearly broke us.
Oh my word. I enjoyed that though. In hindsight, you forget the pain, you know?
You do. Yeah. You just remember the good times, don't you?
Yeah.
And we're in that. We've got some great memories, Matt. We're in that old retirement home for old podcast makers. Yeah. It'll be us. We have Waze Boys in the corner with some whiskey, regaling the old tales. Fantastic. So, I mean, we probably should get into production first for this one.
I think so.
Guns and Avarone, 1961.
So, filmed in 1960, principally on location in Rhodes in Greece. And then it was followed by another 4 months in London. And I'll talk a bit more about that in a moment. But
sure.
I watched a really interesting little featurette. Like a behind-the-scenes featurette, like a very early, idea of making a featurette about a film that's being made.
It's very prim and proper, isn't it? I've seen the one you're talking about.
And it was narrated by Carl Foreman, who was the producer and screenplay writer. And he's great. And he talks about the making of the film, and there's a little black and white behind-the-scenes footage of them on location and going to lunch. And Tony Quinn, jumps on the back of
Stanley Baker at one point. You're on friendly terms. Me and Tony.
Anyway,
me and Big Tone. We go way back in Albania with the SOE. I remember I was there.
That's Quail. You fucked it already. Quail. There's two Tonys in there.
Guadalcanal. There you go.
So it's really great. It's on YouTube. Go and find it.
It's quality stuff.
I'm sure we'll throw it on the Twitter this week. Mm. X, whatever it's called now. But basically, Foreman talks about a lot of the production side of things, and it's an absolute goldmine. One of the most interesting things is the amount of help that Greece provided to make the film.
Yes.
He brokered a deal that allowed them to film on the island of Rhodes with the support and assistance of the Greek government and the Greek military. And the way he tells it, they had to amend a treaty between Greece and Turkey that demilitarized the area to allow the Greek Navy and military to operate around and assist in the actual production of the film.
Wow.
Blows my mind that if that's true, I couldn't corroborate it
They're even mediating in the middle. Come on, Chess. let's get the picture of the line. There's only a bit of water. It'd be fine.
Exactly. Hired 1,000 Greek soldiers to betray the German army. We'll talk more about the kit that crops up from the Greek army and the navy. The Greek prime minister visited. The entire Greek royal family visited on location.
Wow.
And there's some great little shots of them all chatting to Gregory Peck and the Tonys.
They've all come to see me, David Niven. Their favorite man. Hello, Your Majesty.
Well, the way Foreman puts it, it's European royalty meets Hollywood royalty.
Oh yes,
yeah,
yes, yeah. love it.
So the film was made for about $6 million, which is a huge sum for 1960.
Massive,
and it was the top grossing film of 1961, and the box office was just under $30 million, which is again huge.
That's some take.
Yeah, exactly. But the amount of money that Foreman poured into this picture is insane. So the gun cave at the end of the film. That cost more than £100,000 to build. Yeah. Three stories high. It had to be built twice because rain damaged it the first time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, incredible stuff. And that was built at Shepperton, I believe, in London.
Yeah.
So filming was in Shepperton and then Elstree Studios, where they did that big storm sequence, which is in the middle of the film, and some of the swimming at the end where they jump off the cliff. Of course, the film is based on Alistair MacLean's 1957 bestseller. The plot's entirely fictional, but the story takes place during that disastrous 1943 Greek campaign.
It's like Faction a little bit, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. There's lots of changes between the book and the film, although many of the characters remain the same. There's the identity of the traitor changes, and some of the character traits are moved around a bit. And of course, Peck is playing a British character. And he famously didn't want to do the accent. Famously, just like Niven last week, didn't want to do the American accent in Real Glory.
I wonder if he mentioned that. Yeah,
it's absolutely fine, Greg. I didn't bother in 1939 in the Real Glory either. So
no one will care. Don't worry. Don't worry.
So MacLean's famous for HMS Ulysses, Ice Station Zebra, When Eight Bells Toll, Where Eagles Dare, Force 10 from Navarone. Prolific like novelist and screenplay writer. But the screenplay for the actual film itself, as I mentioned earlier, was done by Foreman, and he himself was a prolific writer, writing the screenplay for The Bridge on the River Kwai, The Victors, and Young Winston as well. Well as Force 10 later on in 1978. During the war, he helped out writing the script for Know Your Enemy. The Japan entry, 1945. Fascinating
Capra
character,
did those, didn't he?
He did. On Capra in a moment. He was blacklisted in the 50s as a communist sympathizer, so he came over and worked in the UK. Film was directed by J. Lee Thompson, best known for Ice Cold and Alex in 58, Northwest Frontier with Ken Moore in 1959, which is a really great film. Cape Fear, 1962.
Yes, absolutely adore Cape Fear.
The Passage in 1979. And Death Wish 4, The Crackdown. This over 1987.
What a drop off.
What do you mean drop off?
No, I know, but like those Death Wish sequels are diminishing returns.
They are, but
the only one's good where he's got them. That bazooka.
That's the one, isn't it?
That's the one. Right.
Cinematography was provided by Oswald Morris, who was a bomber pilot during the war. He worked on The Man Who Never Was, Heaven Knows Mr. Allison, A Farewell to Arms, the 1957 version, The Hill, which, you know, a film that we love on the show.
Watch. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The Spy Who Came in from the Cold in 65. The Man Who Will Be King, 1975. Incredible film. The cinematography on that is...
We'll have to do that one.
...stunning. And, of course, The Great Muppet Caper, 1981.
Wow. Amazing. Yeah. I love it when we go into, like, the cinematography, like, credits, because there could be some wild stuff in there.
We don't always have the time.
We don't.
In an ideal world, just going off... tangent from a classic FOF. I'd love to have enough time to talk about the editors and the cinematographers every week.
I know, because we try and always, don't we? We try and
there's such important parts of the process of making a film.
Yeah.
And we never really have much of a chance to discuss those side of things. Other than some of the cinematography.
Sorry, I'm not name dropping, but I was talking to a producer the other day about this, planning an episode we're going to do soon. Yeah. And I was saying that the thing we like to do on the show is just gently remind everyone every week that, look, these things just don't appear. And obviously I know that everyone listening knows that, but I think it can be lost in when you're talking about a film, you know, from the caterer, the grip to the carpenters, from the ground up, like there's just this entire mass of people that make this thing work just to get a camera in front of Niven and Peck. I think it's incredible. I think that's why we love film so much, don't we?
Again, that is really highlighted in that behind the scenes featurette with Foreman, and you know, they hired the same guy that did the catering for Bridge Over the River Kwai.
Yeah.
And the way he phrases it is, well, we thought if he could serve lunch to 600 people in the Ceylon jungle, he'd manage it on roads.
Piece of piss. Come on.
Yeah. Great. can't recommend that feature enough. Moving on, the score was is by Dimitri Tomkin, who worked on lots of westerns.
What a theme!
And it is amazing. It's great. It just the way it's feathered through all those sequences.
The reprise of it every now and then.
Yeah, yeah.
It really. It's, I don't know why, but I always get confused with Zulu. It has a to me. It has like a sound. Ish connection to Zulu. I don't know
well,
why.
It swells, doesn't it? It swells in a similar sort of way.
Builds, yeah, it's very good. One of the classics.
Well, Tomkin was a master of his craft, you know, nominated for 22 Oscars, won 4 of them.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Worked with Frank Capra throughout the war, worked on absolutely dozens of films with Capra. Post-war, worked on A Wonderful Life, Red River, The Thing, the original The Thing. Okinawa, High Noon, Take the High Road, Ceasefire, The Alamo, and 55 Days at Peking, which is another Niven movie.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And he was paid, Rob. He was paid the staggering sum of $50,000, which at the time was the most any film composer had been paid for a single film.
Oh, drinks on Tomkin then.
Right?
Blimey.
Incredible amount of just credits.
Well, I mean, it shows in the work, phenomenal doesn't credit. It? You know, it's the timeless movie theme.
On a lighter note, I was reading Niv, which is an authorized sort of biography of Niven, and it talks about how bored he was on set in Rhodes, which rightfully bored. And
I love to hear it.
It talks about he picked up a copy of The Hollywood Reporter one day, and he looked at the front cover, and the splash was. That his production company, Four Star, which he set up with Dick Powell and Charles Boyer, had gone bankrupt. Oh. And Powell and Boyer were like calling him out for being off sunning himself, having fun in Greece while their company's collapsing and they're going bankrupt. And Niven's like panicked. He's stricken. Yeah. He's like, oh my God, what's happening? Like heading for the phone. And then he realizes it's the April edition and it's an April Fool's joke. Can you imagine going, you know what? David's off on holiday at the moment. We should definitely almost tank our company by putting out...
Let's put the shits up.
In the industry paper, in the industry mag, we should just... We've gone bankrupt on the front cover. They bought the front cover for a joke.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Like, it is. Internet days. That's great. Just imagine Niven rushing around, all panic-stricken and hating the fact he's in Rhodes as well.
What if he just like headed for the Mess Webley and just give like oh my God,
jumped off a cliff or something, like it's all over, I'm ruined.
So the film was nominated for 7 Academy Awards in 1962: Best Motion Picture, Best Director, Screenplay, Best Editing, Musical Score, and Best Special Effects, which it won. And the winners were Bill Warrington, who was a specialist with the visual effects, and Chris Greenham, a sound effects editor. And they, between them, have the most incredible careers. If you want to sit aghast for 5 minutes, just go and have a look at their IMDb credit list. So many formative, incredible films that they both worked on. And that kind of rounds out production. Cool. It's a really fascinating production. There's a couple of things I'm going to pepper in throughout.
Yeah, there's a hell of a lot more. We've got some extra tidbits here and there.
Think Rob's going to mention in a moment as well regarding Niven, but they worked them hard. They were working from like 6 till 6 most days, and then those scenes for the storm sequence that they filmed in the tank, cold water. Apparently Peck was like nailing the brandies, and Niven was very
impressed. Read that this week.
So yeah, I mean, that takes us into cast, Rob.
So we'll do cast, and then we'll do the one web reviews and the retro review. So, I mean, the cast, I mean, I've got it down here. Gargantuan stars of their day. It's like an Avengers Assemble level casting. And I even think even now with what Marvel get in for their Avengers level movies, they're still not as big as these classic pictures and the sort of the huge names they get in. So we'll go through, and there's not enough time to mention everyone in it this week because the cast is just huge. But obviously, I've picked out the main players, and I will be reading their character bios as we go along from my 1961 Guns of Navarone tie-in brochure.
What a flex. What a flex this is, ladies and gentlemen.
I know, right? £8 it cost me a few years ago. I just had to buy it. So we have Gregory Peck as Mallory. Once the greatest mountain climber in the world, he knew the job was impossible, but he had no choice, for 2,000 lives were at stake. And a five-time Oscar nominee will be no stranger to fans of the show. Porkchop Hill, Cape Fear, Hornblower, To Kill a Mockingbird, he won the Academy Award for that in 1962. The Scarlet and Black, 12 O'Clock High, Boys from Brazil, I could go on ad nauseum. Peck, you know, is one of the classic Hollywood stars. And I found a little tidbit from a Gregory Peck biography from 2002 by Gary Fishgall, talking about how Peck sort of described working with everyone and what they were like. So he says, Greg jokingly described the complications as thus. David Niven really loves Tony Quayle, and Gregory Peck loves Anthony Quinn. Tony Quayle breaks a leg and is sent off to hospital. Tony Quinn falls in love with Irene Pappas, and David Niven and Peck catch each other on the rebound and live happily ever after. Perfect.
I read somewhere that Peck was described the film as, why are we carrying Anthony Quayle around all the time?
Yeah. I saw that as well. And then we have David Niven as Miller, the misfit, but a genius with high explosives. After every obstacle was clear, everything would depend on him. So David Niven is also an Academy Award winner for Best Actor for 1958 Separate Tables. Interesting enough, he was 23 minutes in that movie. It's one of the shortest performances ever to win an Oscar. But, you know, as again, fans of the show will know most of these anyway, but he's in The Way Ahead, Best of Enemies, Charge of the Light Brigade, The Real Glory that we covered last week, A Matter of Life and Death, Dawn Patrol, First of the Few, Carrington VC and Paper Tiger. And that's only his war films. He's got so many more. And I've got a little thing that he wrote in his 1971 huge smash bestseller biography, Moon's a Balloon. And he said, The Guns of Navarone was a long and physically very arduous picture, culminating in 5 weeks in England in November, simulating a storm at sea by working 9 freezing hours a day in a huge tank of filthy water.
Nothing bad can happen in a big tank of filthy water, surely.
Of course, he didn't get really ill and had to go to hospital and then sort of escape hospital in a way, come back and film and then get even more ill. Yeah. What a trooper. I'm not going to let them do the movie without me. I'm breaking out. I'll side myself out.
I hear Columbia shitting themselves about this one.
Yes. Peck's got a delicious bottle of brandy. I'll be fine. Anyway, then we have Anthony Quinn as Andrea, the Greek giant killer without mercy, who hated only two things in life, Germans and Keith Mallory. Anthony Quinn, again, 4-time Oscar nominee. He was in They Died With Their Boots On, Guadalcanal Diary, Back to Bataan, Last Train from Gun Hill, Lawrence of Arabia and Lost Command, to name but a few. Another real big heavyweight actor of his day. Yeah. Yep. Then we have Anthony Quayle as Franklin, one of the war lovers. He was unable to understand why none of the others shared his enjoyment of danger as Franklin. And Quayle himself was, as we mentioned before, a former SOE operative, worked in Albania with the SOE. He wrote I don't know what you would call it, like a semi-self-insert fiction.
It's a somewhat autobiographical novel, I guess.
Novel, that's it.
Great read. He was a brilliant writer. I wish he'd written more.
No, me too. And that was reissued by the IWM lately. The last couple of years, they reprinted some war classics, and that's in there. Really recommend it to FOF listeners if you haven't given it a go. But anyway, Quayle, Battle of the River Plate, Ice Cold and Alex, Lawrence of Arabia, HMS Defiant, Operation Crossbow, just another absolute, you know, back catalogue of movies, and many, many more that I haven't mentioned. Then we move on to Sir Stanley Baker as Butcher Brown. The Butcher of Barcelona, he had been killing longer than any of them since 1937 in Spain. He was about ready to quit, though he hardly knew it himself. And again,
the best man with a knife I've ever seen.
Yes. And again, you know, Baker, BAFTA winner. He was one of the most popular actors in England when they cast him. Apparently word is people were surprised that he was in it because he's such a small role, but he really wanted to be involved because of all the other names. But as I say, Baker's credits include Yesterday's Enemy, Hell Drivers, The Cruel Sea, The Red Beret, Zulu, Sea Fury, Hell in Korea, A Prize of Arms, and The Last Grenade. And that's just his war work, not to mention the tons of neo-noir movies he did in the 50s as well. What a class act, one of my favourite actors of all time. Then we have James Darren as Papademos. It says, the baby-faced killer from Navarone. They sent him to America for an education, and he got the wrong kind. War gave him a license to murder. And James Darren...
All of four lines in this film.
Yes, didn't have much to do. But he's good. Everyone's great in this. But he's a little bit of a stunt casting for it today. In 1961, he had a huge top three US Billboard 100 hit called Goodbye Cruel World. He was a pop singer and actor, as I mentioned. Operation Mad Bull, All the Young Men. TV credits include Hawaii Five-O, SWAT. And he was in Star Trek Deep Space Nine as Vic Fontaine. And
there's a hologram.
Yeah. Oh, really? Okay, fair enough.
He was a hologram crooner from the 50s.
Oh, wow, that's perfect.
So he basically played himself as a hologram
for. Perfect. I love it. Then we have James Robertson.
Fun fact before you move on, was on his honeymoon with his wife. He got married the day before filming began.
Oh, amazing. Oh, well, so congratulations. Very belated.
They had their honeymoon on Rhodes.
Oh, well, there you go. And Columbia paid for the privilege. Fantastic.
Nice.
And then we have James Robertson Justice as Jensen. He's essentially playing M. I read in a autobiography that someone wrote of him. Not an autobiography, a biography, saying he's the M of the picture. And he fought in Spain in the Spanish Civil War for the Republic. And his films include For Those in Peril, Hornblower, Orders to Kill, Foxhole in Cairo. And he's in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. As the Baron or the Lord, I can't remember his name.
He's an incredible presence, whatever film he's in.
No, he was the owner of the sweet shop, wasn't he? In Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Yeah, but no, he's one of those actors. I always think in this film, it's between him and Hawkins to have that role.
Mm.
And if Hawkins wasn't ill with cobalt treatment, he'd have got that role. But it's just another absolute powerhouse. Then we have Brian Forbes as Cone. He's only in it for a small bit. But Brian Forbes, The Wooden Horse, Cold It Story, I Was Monty's Double, Yesterday's Enemy, League of Gentlemen. I mean, what a credit list again. Then you have a young Richard Harris as the Australian pilot Barnsby. It was bloody awful.
Or Ruddy if you watch the UK version.
The Channel 4 version is bloody.
When it first came out, they overdubbed, apparently. They dubbed the bloodies to ruddies.
Okay. Well, it would have been far too close to the bone. The Channel 4 streaming service, which is the HD version, which I must add that Netflix did have, is well worth seeking out if you can put up with all the ad breaks. Richard Harris, again, he would go on to become an Academy Award nominee twice. I think he was in Heroes of Telemark, Long the Short or the Tall, Major Dundee, Wild Geese, Gladiator, The Snow Goose, Cromwell. We all know Richard Harris. He was also Dumbledore as well.
He was in line for the Miller role, wasn't he?
Yes, apparently so. Yes.
And so many people were attached to the Mallory and Miller roles.
I think at this
Cary
point,
Grant was Harris rumored and
big enough, perhaps.
Yeah.
This is pre-sporting life, pre-Oscar nomination, isn't it?
He's doing an Australian accent in this film.
Sometimes it comes
occasionally.
And goes.
Yeah.
I wanted him to be it more. I wanted them to take him along. If they could have worked him in as a new character, like saying, "Oh, I know, I can get you in," or whatever. Maybe I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah.
Then we have Irene Pappas as Maria. She was in Lions of the Desert, Zorba the Greek, and Z. We have Gia Scala, a Liverpudlian actress. You'd never know from her accent. As Anna, Battle of the Coral Sea, TV show called Convoy, which is a 50s American serial about convoys, I can't find a version of it online, which is a shame. And she was also in 12 O'Clock High. And then just rounding out cast, because we'd be here forever, because there's a lot of people. Small roles for Michael Trubshaw. Obviously, it's a Niven film. Trubshaw's going to be in there. Apparently, he was quite pleased when he found out that Niven was attached. It's only a small role.
He was Weaver, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's it. And they were both apparently in the Highland Light Infantry together during the war. That's how they knew each other. And then
I believe Niven's cat badge at the beginning is HLI.
Yeah. It is, yeah. Been learning some fascinating things about him and his time in the Commandos from Tom Petch's SAS book, which everyone needs to go out and read. It's fantastic. And then we have, and you can't have You cannot have a classic
I already know what you're going to say.
I know you know. You can't have a classic war film without the reputable Percy Herbert as Sergeant mm-hmm. Grogan in about 2 minutes of footage. But you just can't not literally have him in just, there.
Just walks up to someone and says, the boat's ready, and then walks
it's
off.
It's great. I love it. I love it. I wish Herbert was still with us, because the stories he must have had being in all these movies.
Did he write a book at all, or did anyone write a book?
I don't know. I don't think
him?
He did.
I've never actually looked.
We've looked
I keep
for
meaning
it.
To.
Yeah. I think we made... an AI program make us a war movie where Herbert played every character. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. Remember.
Herbert's Heroes or something, wasn't it? Yeah. Anyway, so
we should have done an episode on that. Really,
we really should. Maybe one day when we run out of ideas. Now we have a retro review, and I've gone more recent with the retro review this week because I think in retrospect, this is one of the movies that endures from that period quite well.
Definitely.
So I went with Empire magazine from 2006, penned by Ian Nathan.
Good old Empire.
Yes, and I've picked two paragraphs this week. A hardy perennial of that grand tradition of World War II men on a mission movies, usually adapted, as the case here, from gutsy MacLean novels, this conventional but thrillingly made and performed adventure in many ways symbolises the entire subgenre. Its dedicated mechanics have been purloined by countless other movies, but never quite to the same effect. J.D. Thompson understood the precision wrought simplicity. Avoiding ambiguity like an enemy patrol can reap glorious dividends. The film was a big hit. Although beyond the calling of its plot, the set of likable characters do come intelligently alive, and there is a real directorial skill in the growing tension of the finale. This is not just a matter of blindly going through the motions, violently out of fashion, perhaps, but the inspirational in its own tidy way. A boy's own classic.
It's a good review.
Very. Yeah, I think it sums it up perfectly. And moving on, if I can open my phone and bring it up. This week's one-word reviews. And obviously, I mean, thank you again, everyone, for your gargantuan response to our 150th episode announcement. I mean, we knew a few of you knew because you listened the week before, but, you know, we were staggered. It's had nearly 40,000 views on X or Twitter, whatever we're calling it. Nearly 330 likes at the time of recording.
Wow.
Just a massive response. I'll be able to read a few. We'll be here for a while. But R. Burgos goes with Opa. We have David Current goes with Classic. Brian Williams, Philosopher. Lydia Jane, Niven and Peck, What More Could You Want? Historic Firearms, I think we know him as Matthew Moss. My co-host and confidant goes with Ali, quite rightly. Lost in Translation goes with Legendary. Lance Nielsen goes with Classic. John G. Dooley goes with Boom. The Hansford Institute goes with Darren. Azzy goes with Harris Dubbing, all one word. David Hopes goes with Rat. And Ken Reaney goes, Why? Dr. Stephen Maturin goes with Impregnable. Edward Lewis rounds it out with Exceptional. And there were many more, but
there were literally hundreds.
There were lots. There was a lot. But yeah, I mean, I think it just proves
response.
It just proves how loved this movie is. I mean, we know when we're going to hit them on the show that these movies are going to be like the outpouring of love for them is just so much.
Well, I'm sure we'll talk about it later on, but the place that the film holds in the popular consciousness still,
yeah, you know,
50 years after it came out, is really something. It's in that glut of films like The Great Escape, Zulu, Battle of Britain.
Kelly's Heroes.
In that group of films that that a lot of people grew up with. There's a nostalgia link, but also it's great cinema.
Exactly.
It's timeless.
It hits all the beats. And there's someone for everyone. It's this whole thing of that casting is, oh, I've seen him in that. Oh, he's great in that. Oh, I've seen Peck in this. Oh, I've seen Quinn in this. It's this whole hitting everything right, somehow everything falling into place. And that doesn't happen very often in cinema or film anymore, I don't think. Because I personally know we have the stars, but I think to do movies like this, I think it's more risky than it ever has been because of obviously trying to get the money back, trying to not make a flop. I think studios become very scared of making something big and it failing.
And it's sad that the closest we get to it now is like the Expendables or Marvel.
Yeah, exactly. Really. And even the Expendables kind of prove that that kind of movie.
Expendables, yeah.
Yeah, Expendables, yeah. The Expendables doesn't really... I mean, it hits for a certain amount of people, but it doesn't necessarily hit like it used to.
No, agreed. Just to jump off on the popular culture side of things there. Again, the film sits within, it's not just like a British thing, like some films are.
Mm.
It's more than that. I mean, you've got Tarantino referencing it in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
You've got it being parodied in Hot Shots Part 2.
Yeah, the boat sequence. Yeah.
You've got a level on Call of Duty United Offensive in 2005. And
Wu-Tang Clan, Method Man, Guns N' Roses, Tearing Up Your Battle Zone from Triumph, featuring Cappadonna from their 1997 comeback album.
Yep. Wu-Tang Forever, man. Yeah.
Wu-Tang! Yeah, man. Fantastic.
Ain't nothing
love
to
it.
Fuck with. Anyway, moving on.
Final film, ain't nothing to fuck with. Moving on to the Alley Sally.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
It's time for Alley Tally on Fighting on Film.
The 150th Alley Tally.
150 Alley Tallies is an incredible feat. So
it really
I think
is.
Before we dive into it, I'm just going to explain in case anyone's been listening since day one and has never really known what Alley Tally means.
What's an Alley Tally?
What the hell? Anyway, so essentially, Alley is cool military kit, stuff that's unique, interesting, looks a bit cool. It's British parlance, and Tally is like tally chart, bar chart,
tally chart
type stuff.
Yeah.
Put them together, yeah. Alley Tally. It rolled off the tongue.
Yeah.
We thought it was a good idea for
another segment title,
but it confused a lot of people.
It still does. But I must say another big thank you to Chas Mina for doing those. And he sent us a big long reel of takes
he
of that Alley Tally.
And I love him for doing it.
Oh, it's fantastic. Chas, if you're listening, thanks again for that voiceover there. It was fantastic. We never want to change it. Anyway, but I'll kick off the Alley Tally this week by just saying. Some of the fits on show, some of the drip.
Oh, that's my second entry. Is just the drip
when they change from their battle dress into their sort of trying
How
to blend
does Niven
in.
Keep that beret on throughout the storm.
It must be pinned like at the back or something,
right?
But he's got like Niven with his little cap and navy pea coat, polka dot scarf. You've got Baker in the beanie hat and like the rough sort of naval look,
and that beard,
Baker does something to me in that movie. Just, oh, geez. You know, if I wasn't a married man and it was 50 odd years ago.
I mean, Anthony Quinn in that white suit with the shoulder holster does it for me. And that mustache.
Listen, Niven in battle dress as well. Like, that is really nice. Because
you only get
really
that in the way ahead and Paper Tiger.
Exactly. He looks so good in it. Everyone looks so great. The characterization in the costume is really good for me. Like Quinn with his sheepskin. You've got Quail wearing sort of company man type stuff. He's not as rough as the rest.
Shout out to James Robertson Justice's, casual suit that he's wearing when he's giving the briefing.
It's fantastic. Yeah.
Looking sharp.
Quail looking like in that sequence looks like he's just got back from Albania in his SOE gear. Like he just looks like he's rolled into an O group after, you know. Like, I left a load of Vickers guns there for them. They'll find those in 40 odd years. Anyway, but it's just the costuming is great in this.
It is.
And it's just, I love it. Matt, off you go.
Well, another gem from Foreman's behind the scenes featurette was the guns, the titular guns. We've got to talk about them. They weighed over 15 tons, Rob.
Wow.
Yeah. They were 80 feet long.
I thought it was like camera trickery or something.
15 tons, 80 feet long. And he claims that they were the biggest prop ever made for a movie up until that point.
I bet they were. Yeah. Huge.
He says that they were bigger than Germany's Big Berthas used during World War One and Two.
Do you know what they actually were? Do you know or not?
I think they're just meant to be like 12 or 15 inch guns, I'm sure, okay, or something like that. But they look great.
Yeah, they do look fantastic. Yeah. They're very
really
imposing.
Do look great.
I think it's something I was talking about to my wife the other day. We're watching Chernobyl. It's very hard to make a building scary, but they do it in this, and they obviously do it in, it's, you know, an RBMK reactor exploding. It's completely different, but doing that as a filmmaker, as a visionary director, you know, cinematographer, making a building imposing can be quite hard, and they get it in this. It's like the castle and the cliff and the mountain in Where Eagles Dare. It's the same energy. I
read somewhere that they redressed that the cave set for Where Eagles Dare, the cable car bit. But
it wouldn't surprise me. Maybe.
It's possible.
They blew fuck out of it at the end, so they might have to do a bit of rebuilding.
They did, but who knows? What else is in there? I've already mentioned Tony Quinn's shoulder holster, which is peak.
Very
he's
cool.
Sat there on the bed with the paper, and he's got his Enfield little, number
pulls
two.
Pulls out his Enfield.
One star.
Love it.
Like, wait, who's coming through this door? Oh, it's just Gregory.
It's Gregory. It's me. Hello. I can't do Gregory Peck.
Can't do
it. I'm not going to try again.
So help me God, I will blow up those fucking guns. Can't do it either.
No,
anyway,
it's hard, isn't it? Yeah.
And then, of course, there's, you know, the Hellenic army pops up with 1,000 soldiers, M101 howitzers, Chaffees, M8 Greyhounds.
All that Lend-Lease stuff they bought, yep.
Fucking six actual destroyers.
Hello.
Like, Foreman's like, do you have any destroyers we can borrow? And the Greek Navy's like, yeah, we got like
we bought a ton after the war. Yeah. Probably some of those destroyers have probably been all around the world during the war.
They were former US Navy destroyers. One of them survives, actually. It's a USS Albany. It's a museum ship now.
Fourth trip. We need to see it.
Right. shout out to Nibbin's explosive rat. Which
it's really cool, isn't it?
It's a little joke in the film, but was a real thing, and they did do that with
I like it.
SOE. It was really a nice inclusion.
I've got to start on the Sten chat. There's so many Stens in this, and interesting
and
ones at that
as well.
Mark One stars, So me and Matt, like obviously Matt, if you don't know, Matt's a firearms historian. It's his life's like, you know, his calling, his profession. And me and Matt always wonder, where did all the Mark One stars go? Because everyone knows a Mark One, everyone knows a Mark Two, but they don't know a Mark One star, which is the first iteration of a full production Sten. And I think this movie's got the most in one area.
There's a handful of films, isn't there, that have Mark One stars in them.
633 Squadron's got a few.
Yeah, Telemark.
There's another one that's got them in.
Paratrooper's got them in, hasn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
Paratrooper 2.
But they don't fire them. They don't fire them in this.
No, they don't.
There's a sequence.
I tell you what, before we move on to the travesty of the Stens you're about to mention.
Yeah.
If everyone holds the Sten by the magazine in this film.
It's classic.
And that's
cliche.
And that fascinates me because the manual says you hold it by the barrel nut or by the trigger mechanism housing underneath the gun. You don't hold it by the magazine because it can induce a stoppage. And you would think Quail and Niven would
Niven
know
would
that.
Know that. Yeah.
Well, they don't give a shit. They know it looks cool.
Yeah, exactly. It's how you expect
plenty,
it.
To be fair,
film.
There are plenty of photographs of guys, actual guys during the war.
It's tons.
Holding them that way. Like, let's not.
Exactly. And it fits.
Just because the manual says it. I mean,
that looks and feels right. If you've ever held a Sten, you instinctively want to hold the magazine, don't you? Mm-hmm. I think that's why they probably put a foregrip on it on their Mark V to stop guys doing it.
And on the Mark I as well, the Mark I before they simplified it with the Mark I Start, it did have a little folding foregrip just underneath the magazine.
Oh, yeah, that weird sort of underneath thing that makes it look a bit, looks
so ungainly. And it is ungainly. I've handled T40, the very first Sten gun.
Oh, wow. All right, flex. All right, I might have a Guns N' Everone.
You cracked out the Guns N' Everone book, didn't you? So I'm going to mention the time I took apart T40, the first Sten gun. All right.
Come on.
It does feel proper and gainly, and it's very unusual.
You can tell why they put it on a diet when they went commercial, because I don't think the Woodstocks would have just, you know, crippled the firearms industry at the time.
Which is when needed. Just extra work. But...
Exactly.
We got to talk about the other Sten.
Yeah, they've got. See, now Mark II Stens appear, and I'm thinking, oh, okay, they might have just had these. I've not seen them, but then they fire, and there's no recoil, and there's this very odd flash coming out.
They're holding them in a very weird way as well.
And they're holding them in.
They can't get their hand around the whole stock.
Yeah, and what they are is they're Stens with a gasket fitted on. And they're in a few movies. There's one in an episode of The Four Just Men where Hawkins.
Yes, I remember you telling me about that.
Yeah, is trying to stop a sort of uprising by a rogue. That's set in Greece, that episode, actually, I think, on a Greek island. And there's one in that. And you can clearly see the gas tank coming up the guy's back and through his sleeve and into the gun. So there's clearly a separate little tank that they're wearing or that you put to one side. But they're just really odd. Because we can't find out and we can't work out why they've got them and they're not using blank firers. I'd assume safety, but even then,
safety or
it's the 60s.
It's true. I don't know. It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe.
But they just look terrible.
They look funny.
We're going to talk favorite scenes in a minute, but the scene I really hate in this film is when Papademos strolls out and starts like just hip firing like entire like section of Germans.
He does like two boxes of 9mm there, doesn't he?
I know, in right? He must have had a Lanchester magazine. And then he's like one on one with another German officer
who's also found a Sten from somewhere.
Yeah, who has a Sten, and it's the one of the gas ones, and they're just like blasting each other.
Well, it could be an MP3008, but they're not out for another 2 years. So that's a German copy of a Sten for anyone who doesn't know. But it's not. It's clearly not. And that scene is the only one of the few scenes that I don't like, because it's just a bit silly.
They could have done his death in a much more weighty way, I think.
I like the line
that Quinn has at the end. He forgot what he was fighting for, or whatever it was at the end.
Goes a bit glazed-eyed, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. He goes a bit kill happy.
And he does riddle that Jerry. I mean, that Jerry.
Well, he riddles all of those Jerrys.
Riddles them.
He does a cracking job, but the gas firing Sten just takes me out.
Because there's no recoil, I think.
And I know that's rivet countery.
It takes something
bad
away from it. It does. But the reason we surmise that the Mark I's weren't fired, because there's a scene, the boat scene, Quayle's opening up on the. On the ship, on the Kriegsmarine, and he's doing like he's flailing around with a Sten as if he's firing it, but there's no flash coming out, and there's no the bolt's not moving. So
there's that bit where they swap vehicles after they're in German kit, and there's a radio man in the back of the one they're commandeering, and we think, oh no, he's going to get a message off, but no, Quinn just. Like steps around the side and just absolutely loads on it.
I always wonder why they don't just use the MP40s, because there's an abundance of them, isn't there?
There is,
I don't know. Maybe it's just.
But with that scene where he shoots the radio guy in the truck, I always thought, that is actually, a firing Sten. But I watched it again. It kind of cuts away to just squibs going off inside.
Yes.
Rather than you actually seeing Quinn. Fire the gun. It's possible.
But moving on from Sten.
Live firing was the Sten.
From Sten chat. Because we love a Sten on the show. I think every British man or woman does love a Sten. I think you're contractually obliged.
Deep down.
at birth to love the Sten. We are Sten enjoyers. Anyway, as I mentioned, MP40s, I really like the 1934 Mauser pocket pistol, which is the only pistol they seem to have in the movie with the silencer. Every time you see that weapon produced with the silencer, someone's tying the silencer
That's
really cool. Love that. You get some cool sort of Where Eagles Dare type kills with that. That must be a McLean-ness, perhaps.
Yes.
Because it's also
I can almost imagine what the line is. He coolly leveled the silenced Mauser.
Yes. Yes.
Put a single round into the back of the radio operator.
With a silent thud, he dropped the sentry. And then he looked over at Richard Burton and think, we've got to get out of here. Anyway. Then you've got Baker's Fairburn Sykes, which I really like.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Papademos on the Bren on the boat. You never see the Bren again.
And he's got the carry handle locked in the assault.
Very cool. Yeah. Gives it some to those Jerrys.
Oh, Quinn's spike rifle.
Yeah, that's cool. I think it's
a K98K with like a wrap and a scope mounted, I think.
Very nice.
It's Mauser-ish anyway.
Yeah, I'll talk about it later, but that scene is one of the few scenes where I wanted all the lads to pop up with their Stens. It would have been cool, wouldn't it?
I mean, Quinn is metal in that sequence, though.
Oh, it nails. Absolute doesn't nails miss. In that scene.
Doesn't miss.
Of course he doesn't. No. It's like Leia's blaster. It's Quail's sniper.
The best part of it is he gets back to where they're going ahead of them.
Yeah. He's
like, oh.
Hello.
Here at last.
Yes,
I just held up an entire German column.
Yeah, on my own.
And you still took an age carrying Tony Quayle here.
Yes, exactly. And then there's some vehicles in there that are nice. I mean, Matt mentioned it, but there's M24 Chaffees, which I always think this movie makes them look adorably small when they're all like in a line together.
Isn't it weird how the Greyhounds, which are like the wheeled scout car, kind of look the same size as Chaffee in this one?
Yeah. And I like the sort of paint job they've done on them to make them look a bit more German. That's nice.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the Dodges. A Catalina flying boat is in there.
Yeah.
Lancasters, but I think they're model ones. And if you notice, and it always makes me laugh, and I don't know if anyone's ever noticed this but me, but in the sequence where the Lancaster's coming down, when it comes down, obviously it's not the focus of the shot, but there's a Lancaster like in midair. It doesn't move. It's just like solid.
It's in a holding pattern, Rob.
Yeah, well, like hovering. Like a Harrier jump Lancaster, that rare make of Lancaster. But it always makes me laugh. Go and find it if you haven't seen it. The Stukas in there as well. Piper Cub Scout. And there's one, and I was jumping when I saw it. There's one Bedford MW. Oh,
it couldn't be the 150th episode of Final Film if there wasn't a Betty involved somewhere.
I was like, Betty Watch can come back for 1 week.
Yeah.
The Bedford Report. Oh, my God, that's amazing. We should call it that.
Oh, my God, yeah. That's a show.
that's a new feature, the Bedford Report. But, no, fantastic. I mean, a great Ali Tally again. And I think we always find this with these classics, these really, cultural held-on-to movies, is that there's just everything going for them, isn't there?
Yeah, it definitely, there's a layer of something for everyone, whether you are a rivet counter or just not. A casual cinema goer.
Yeah, and there's enough commando book style action in there as well that I love. Unashamedly so, which I really appreciate.
Fun fact, the Greek army provided their best mountain climbers for the film.
Oh, wow. So what, those German troops are... Oh, okay.
Yeah, and some of the sequences where, Peck's climbing stuff.
Oh, yeah, it's obviously not Peck. Yeah. I know they filmed that climbing sequence.
Which you mean he's not the greatest mountain climber in the world.
You know, he might be, but,
so help me God, I will climb this mountain.
They filmed it lying down with a sort of made up bit of set of mountainside. And then it's them climbing on their bellies, and it looks really great with this rear projection. Yeah. Love it. So now I think we should move into favourite scenes.
Hello, I'm Al Murray, and you're listening to Fighting on Film, the world's number one war film podcast.
Rob, what's your favourite scene?
My favourite scenes are, I don't want to rob it off you, but it's when Niven has his monologues.
They are good.
And mostly I just love Niven in this. I mean, I absolutely adore Niven. Like, one of the perennial British actors of his time. And his speeches about leadership, killing, they add to the film. I think if anyone had been giving them, it wouldn't have been powerful enough. You know, the character is a man who doesn't want to be an officer. He doesn't want the responsibility. He's passed himself up so many times. But it's the one where he gives the, he discovers that Mallory is using Franklin as a ruse.
Yes.
And it's just some quotes that I've picked out. It's like, "I'm sorry, old Bean, you chose the wrong uniform," which I love when he's chatting to Baker, being the
because he's having to shave his beard off. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And he says, like, you know, "Suppose your ventriloquist dummy doesn't talk, powerful." And then the line where he says, "You've used up an important human being," and how he enunciates that line is really, really good and weighty. And it's, "I misjudged you. You're rather a ruthless character, Captain Mallory." Sort of finally working out the men he's with aren't perhaps the men he thought they were.
Yeah.
In only a way.
The thing I like about
do.
That scene is the way he flips from comedic to very serious.
Yes.
Because you mentioned today, he says, I think he says, "Not very hygienic, shocking taste in undies too," is a scene later on, which I want to talk about, where they steal the clothing off the Germans.
Mm.
He can flip so well.
That's what he was good at. I mean, you see his performance from Separate Tables. He is that kind of character where he's trying to be funny, but there's this weight and emotion behind what he's saying. And he even doesn't do it in every film he's ever in, but the ones where he does do it, you can genuinely see there is a very good actor there. And I know he didn't ever have any formal acting training, but he's natural at it. It really comes to him. And at the end of the speech where he's going, "I don't care about war anymore, I care about Roy," you just know he's a people person. He cares about human beings. The war to him isn't important. You know, the fact he's good with explosives is just something that war's brought about to him, perhaps. I don't feel like he is a career soldier. He's just in it because he's in it, because you have to be in it, because it's a war.
Yeah, found himself there.
Yeah, that's how I feel about the character. And then the one funny line, and I want to know, and maybe we never will, but is that a ad lib or is that in the script? Because when he puts on the Jerry jacket and hat and he goes, "Hail me," it just seems so off the cuff. I just love it. And it again, it's just the strength of the casting. Niven really ties this movie up, and he's so Niven and Peck so Peck, if that makes any sense. They bounce off each other like batteries that have been put in the wall.
There's a dynamism there,
like
isn't
magnets
there?
It's just great. Like but that's one of my, that is probably my favorite scene, where Niven, the penny drops that you're on a mission with maybe fallible
ruthless
people.
Salts.
Ruthless men.
I agree that's a great scene. Mentioned it earlier, I really love I love Quinn's character in this.
Yes.
You know, former Greek army colonel, just an absolute ruthless bastard.
A tank of a man.
Great presence, amazing presence actually, and a really good backstory for the character and his relationship with Mallory. Mallory gives parole to a German patrol to get their wounded back, and they shoot the wounded and go and blow up Quinn's character's house with his family in it, and he's going to kill Mallory at the end of the war. And that is a really interesting dynamic throughout the film. Could have been explored a little bit more, arguably, but not necessary, because there's enough going on. But I really love that sequence where he holds off the German like Alpine patrol, the Jaegers.
As we mentioned, it's just nails, isn't it? It's just
you
it's
get
just great.
You get a classic through the scope shot as well. And he takes the officers first, Rob. He's a pro. He knows what he's doing.
He drops
the officers
first. He's done this before.
Changing positions.
Yeah.
Not staying in one spot for too long. I just wanted it to go on longer. I just wanted more of Quinn.
So what you're saying is better than the sniper sequence in Anzio. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, that's a difficult. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I hate to disappoint, but you know, Anzio's not fantastic.
It's not. And you said it before we started recording that what you really want in that sequence is like Niven to pop up the Sten gun or a
Bren. Like a stick of dynamite or something.
Yeah.
Mm, just
a little bit of a set piece.
Midway. You don't really get it.
There is another scene I want to talk about a little bit. It's a favourite because it's very tense. And again, Quinn just gives an interesting performance. It's during the interrogation sequence where they're captured after the lit wedding. And
Your Excellency.
Yeah, he's writhing around on the floor, like chewing the scenery. It's, you know, he's going for it.
I love Baker. He's like, you yellow belly. The lines Baker has are perfect for him. There's no one else that can give them. That is very true.
That scene is so interesting because we get the bleach blonde SS officer arrives, and that scene really plays into the good German, you know, the clean here mythos.
It really does. I was watching that,
we're not all like him.
Yeah, I was
literally
wondering.
says it out loud, and it really like does play into that.
I was wondering if you're going to bring that up, because I'd admit I'd have said it if not. I think these movies do that more than we think, and especially in this period of the revisionism and the actual look. You know,
very interesting.
The Wehrmacht were bad, the Kriegsmarine were bad, the Luftwaffe were bad. You know, because they were part of the regime, they were carrying out what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I do think these movies, in their way, as you say, do lean into that myth.
And the SS officer has a Langerpistol, the long barrel Luger, which comes out of nowhere. And he just lays it on Quayle's leg.
Absolute bastard. I was like, what are you doing?
On his gangrenous leg. And then
for the SOE in Albania, you.
He does this thing where he lets it like fall onto its side.
Yeah.
And it's really nicely framed in the shot. And the way he does it is so like delicate and gentle.
It's so menacing, isn't it?
And it is, and it's got that menacing evilness to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a really interesting scene on so many levels, not only because it is a classic interrogation sort of
scene.
You get
the classic cliche of the guy sort of becoming a nervous wreck to try and get them away, and you get the cliche of, oh, I'm ill all of a sudden, I'm having a heart attack, you know.
And the hero officer is just like, what is this bullshit?
I know, they're all looking at you like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah, like, Tony, you're embarrassing us. Can you not?
Exactly. It is that, isn't it, really? Yeah, it's great.
But it works, you know, fair play to him. But yeah, it's an interesting scene, not only because of, you know, those themes, but also the good German mythos that comes in.
Yeah, it is.
We get a little bit of that later, and there's the whole, what's it called? Scopolamine. I was like, is that made up? So I did a bit of research on that, and apparently it is actually a drug that was pushed as a truth serum.
Because Niven's like, supposing they don't have any.
Yeah, like, exactly. That's what Niven talks about. Yeah, like he's just going to get tortured and may never give up the secrets for nothing.
Yeah.
And apparently it emerged in the US in the 20s. It was pushed as a truth serum. Real thing. I think it's really interesting that they do that whole sequence where they bargain within that interrogation sequence. Because there's the whole commando order is a thing at that point. They all have been shot anyway, as spies or commandos.
I think they wouldn't have been in uniform,
they're commandos.
Personally.
They'd have been shot anyway. Mm. There's a great line. It's got nothing to do with that sequence either. But it's you know, we talked about how Baker's lines all fit in really well. There's a line he has earlier in the film where he says, I've been killing Germans since 1937. There's no end to them.
I love it. It's so great.
When he's explaining that he's had enough of killing.
Yeah.
Again, that is a great scene.
Baker plays these damaged men so well, does it his entire career. And I think that's why I love him so much, because there's never...
It's nice to see him get to stretch his legs a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice to see him, because there aren't... I'm doing him a disservice by saying there aren't any other movies in his career where he's up with these big names. But in terms of stardom at the time, like, to have him in it cements him for me as... He is Sir Stanley Baker. You know, there's a reason why he is who he is. And it's, you know, if Hawkins had been younger, maybe it would have worked with him. I know that Kenneth Moore was meant to be that role.
Yeah.
But I don't see Kenneth Moore in that for me.
No, I don't either. I love Ken Moore. I do. And, you know, when we do Northwest Frontier, you'll see him in an action role where he's himself, and it's very human, but it's also very classic British officer. Yeah.
Baker has this sort of thuggishness to him that he can bring out. But he didn't do it all the time, but as I say, it's just good. Maybe we should go into final thoughts.
Yeah.
Matt, take us away.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's supposed to be an anti-war film, and there are elements of that throughout. So, I mean, obviously that dialogue we were just talking about with Baker, mm-hmm. there's Niven's entire sequence where he says, "I just care about Roy." There's Darren's character that becomes, you know, so obsessed with killing that it sees his own death.
It's his undoing. Yeah,
it is. I think the anti-war themes in the film are often forgotten, or perhaps overshadowed by the fact that it's also a classic adventure film. It's also an espionage film. It's a men on a mission film. It just so happens to be, you know, set during the war, and it's, you know, it's also like almost a road trip movie where they're moving from across the hills, and you know, there's even like the classic, there's maps showing their progress kind of thing,
like Indiana Jones.
I love that
Navarone itself is a map painting.
Yes,
that's I just love it.
You can see where they've done it. I love how they like slip in the town on what was probably just an empty bay, and they've painted over it, and it just looks great. It's interesting because the way that the skill of the filmmaking that's been brought to it makes it such an exciting adventure.
Yeah.
Those kind of overshadow the elements of the script that make it an anti-war film to a degree.
Yeah, yeah. Because when the film slows down to try and do that, on repeat viewings, it can feel a little bit forced in, but it's not. But I can see why it's lost.
Yeah, because it's underlying all the way through.
Yeah.
We talked about this actually during our talk about, you know, British Army on film. We talked about fallible men and it portraying the humanity of men in war and people in war.
Mm.
And I think the film strives to do that, and it does hit a couple of really nice scenes, and there's a couple of little bits in the background that work really well, like the interactions between Quinn and the resistance leader lady.
Yep.
I've forgotten the actress's name. That work really well, that show that they have like a mutual respect, and that grows, and then there's an affection. That's nice. But I do think, you know, just you wouldn't go, "Oh, Guns and Navarone, what a great anti-war movie that is."
Yeah, no, it doesn't.
People go,
"Oh,
what a classic action movie. What a classic adventure that is." You just people don't have that in mind. And I think maybe that's a good thing, because maybe, you know, repeat viewing, because it's one of those films, it's always on TV, especially over here in the UK, it's off and on.
Yeah.
And I think it's the same for
it
elsewhere.
It bounces
as well
between streaming services and channels.
I think channels and streaming services keep buying the rights to play it because of its enduring quality as a film.
My point was I was just going to say
that perhaps with repeat viewing, these are the kind of things that you do kind of take on
eventually,
even if you don't see it on the first run through.
The Niven speech about war going on, and there's going to be so many wars till there's no one left, and all that, like, it does come through. But at that point of the film, that's not the point. The point is Roy's being used. You know, Niven is learning that Mallory's a bit of a shit. And then after that, the traitor sequence as well, and, you know, Niven saying, Mallory saying to Niven that, you know, you're in it to the end now, there's blood on your hands type thing. That might not necessarily be construed as directly anti-war, but I get where they're going. But I think, as you said, it does get lost, and I don't think that's a bad thing.
No.
Because at least it hasn't got like a forced in message that other movies around that time try.
Well, there's that
to
sequence where the traitor's unearthed, isn't there? And Niven, you know, berates Peck's character and says, you know, "We've been doing all the lifting. Like, it's time that you, you know, dirtied your hands and you killed."
I wanted Niven to turn around and go, "Well, I did throw TNT into the boat. I did do that."
Oh, that we really, we we should have mentioned that in favorite scenes, because I fucking love that sequence on the boat.
So good.
It's just, it's so good. Like the coup de grace with Niven just throwing the
dashing that TNT into the boat. If only he had lit it with his cigarette, it would have been icing on the top. But it's just great, isn't it? But that's what I think as well makes that scene work, because we've seen Niven do things. We've seen him be quick thinking in the room where they're going to get discovered in the town. And Niven's right, we've got to get out of here. Oh, look, there's an entrance up to the roof. Niven does that.
Yeah.
Niven thinks to put on the German kit, even if they're not going to, even if they are anyway, but he does it first. Mm-hmm. Niven throws the dynamite into the thing. We've seen it happen.
It's the end of the film too. So he's the one that thinks, oh, well, they're going to find the explosives on the guns themselves. I'll hide something in the magazine.
Exactly.
Oh, and shout out to the bit where he lifts up like the powder charge. And Niven, yes, and Peck's face is just like, oh.
Is it a shell? Yeah, exactly. He's like, oh, no, there's this little bad boy as well. You know, and it's not a direct quote, but, you know, like it might as well be. It's just great. He's the glue that holds the movie together. As I say, and for me, final thoughts this week, you know, I've got down here quite possibly the only film that rivals Were Eagles Dare in that men on a mission genre. Mm. Kelly's Heroes is kind of the same, but it's different. It's a different beast. It's perfectly paced.
Tone.
Yes, much different tone. You know, obviously the Vietnam War parallels cannot be misplaced in that one. I say it's almost perfectly paced. No subplots or tangents to muddle the story. There's no romantic subplot, even though there is. It's not really in there much. You know, they haven't got a thing where they've got to do something else and it takes you away from the main action. It's very straight in the way it's presented. Perfect casting, almost. I always say it's Jack Hawkins away from being a 10 out of 10, not a 9.5 out of 10.
Popping up somewhere.
Exactly. It would have been great to have a Hawkins-Baker reunion for Crawl Sea anyway. My only real gripe, and I have two gripes, and they're not huge, and we kind of mentioned it already, that we don't get another shootout, a proper one, with all the cast. I like that. Maybe in the scene where, Quinn is knocking off those mountain troops. I would have loved it if the cast had popped up with Stens to help him out and there could have been some funny quips there, but I understand why they don't.
Peck to light them up as they're coming down the tunnel and then he slams a door in their face.
It would have been nice.
While Niven's setting up the explosive charge.
Because it feels that. Yeah.
We could have had like Gregory Peck with two Sten Mark ones, giving it a bit of Clint Eastwood.
That would have been amazing to have it twice. And then I also think, and I don't know how you feel on this one, I don't know how the listeners feel about this, but I feel like the scene with the storm and with the boat crashing up against the waves goes on just a bit too long. It's the only part of the movie where I'm like, come on, let's get the ball rolling. I've seen the ship smash into that rock about 10 times now. It's the only part of the movie where I'm like, come on.
I know. It's visually, it's very impressive and it looks great exciting. But
you can tell why it won Best Oscar for effects. You can see it.
And you can see that a lot of time and effort was spent on it. And it just maybe 40, 60 seconds cut from it would really...
You'd cut about 2 minutes out, I reckon.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, if you consider what I thought was really interesting about that, actually, that just reminded me, is... From the time Peck leaves the cockpit of the boat, the viewing room, as you call it.
The viewing room. Explain that for the listeners, please, because it makes no sense.
There was an occasion where Rob was trying to think of the name of a bridge of a ship, and he described it as the viewing room.
Could you view the sea from it? So I was like, that makes sense in my brain.
No, there's a definite logic. Anyway.
Such a
Peck leaves the viewing room and he's on deck and the storm's crashing and, you know, poor Tony Quinn's the only guy on the pump. And like Niven's quite in the hold, like sloshing around in like 6 foot of water.
Niven's had an at tea.
Yeah, he is. He's doing the classic
being mother.
He's being mother. Anyway, so what I think is great about that sequence, although it does go on a little too long, is from the moment he leaves the boathouse, the wheelhouse, there's no dialogue up until the point where they're at the base of the cliff.
I think that's why that scene drags. And I think that's why you might have cracked that there. No one's saying anything.
And I can see what they're doing. And, it you know, there's some great acting going on. You know, Niven manages to keep that beret on throughout all of it, which is incredible.
It's pinned. It must be pinned, surely.
It's just sheer will, Rob. Sheer force of will. But we don't really get any dialogue until they're literally pecked, scales the cliff, and, you know, drops the actual rope down for them, and they start climbing, and then there's some discussion at the last. Other than that, it's all done through, you know, visual cues and acting. Yeah. And
it could just be my modern movie brain being like, this needs to be quicker.
And you know what? If I hadn't seen it for, you know, when I watched it for this, I hadn't seen it for, you know, it must be about 18 months, maybe 2 years even.
Oh, wow, okay. I watched it very, very recently. But when we said we were
that might
do
be
it,
because if you know it's coming and it's one of those scenes where you're like, okay, let's get into the story. Mm. And yeah, if you've watched it within like 6-8 months, then I can see how you would think this is dragging a little bit.
Yeah.
But I agree. Yeah. I think if you trimmed a little bit out of it, I think it would be a bit more smell and it would run. Yeah, I agree.
And then my only other gripe, and if you're a long time listener to the show, you'll know I hate it when this happens. Baker's death goes out like goes out on a whimper. Like, yeah. And his little death face
it's a bit
is
confused,
just very
isn't
odd.
It? It's a bit confused because you think, oh, we got him.
Yeah, I think that.
And then he falls back and he's like, oh, they've stabbed each other. Okay.
The shot of him, like, I was like, oh, so did he turn the knife on Baker, his own knife, died by his own sword? I thought that's what was happening.
I mean, how does the German chap's never seen again?
No, yeah.
So I just assume that they stab
no
each other.
No one goes, oh, Butcher Brown's dead in the brig. He's like down there, he's dead. Like, no one ever says anything like that. So what happened to Baker?
Why isn't Stanley in the viewing room?
Butcher, get up to the viewing room quick. See this, see the guns and have road going up. Oh, he's been stabbed. You know, like.
Yeah, I always just assumed that they stabbed each other somehow.
Yeah, but it must have. Yeah,
it's a muddled sequence. I know what they're trying to go for, and it's playing into that anti-war. You know, he's getting his. It's the characters.
Live by the sword, die by the sword.
It's the full circle element of it, isn't it? You know, it is.
But it annoys me because I was like, why has Baker got a small sort of group of movies where he goes out like a bit of a chump? His cruel sea. He gets a sick and he's not in it again. And Red Beret gets a candlestick on his
it's terribly
parachute. Terribly overdubbed. So it just adds to the list of movies. I'm like, oh, Baker, it's not fair. But anyway, I'm glad that he was in it. But there was, I think, you know, there is the Guns of Navarone there. And I don't, as I say, I got my gripes, but I still love it. I still absolutely adore it.
It's an absolute classic. And as I mentioned earlier, it does fit into that small cadre of like iconic war movies of the period, doesn't it?
The fact it's still being referenced every now and then, it's still in the consciousness. Mm-hmm. It's a movie that as we say, if you can get a movie like this to transcend the genre that it's in and have Method Man from the Wu-Tang Clan name check it, have Tarantino. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously Tarantino's a movie guy, but having him name check it, you know, it surely that cements it, doesn't it?
I think so. And that's why it had to be our 150th episode.
Yeah, it did. And I think what a fitting film to top off our 150th celebrations.
Absolutely.
Thanks again for listening, everybody. And if you're brand new to the show and you've checked us out because you saw 150th and you saw Guns of Navarone, please do visit our website, fightingonfilm.com, where you can find the entire back catalogue of the show. Start with Theirs is the Glory, 1946, the film that started the show, and try and catch up. And if you do, let us know. We'll give you a shout out. Anyway, thanks again for listening. And just want to say a massive thank you to all the listeners, everyone who's shared, everyone who's written a review for 150 episodes for the nearly 3 years we've been doing this. Us going from, you know, being lucky to get 100 listens to being in top tens of Apple podcast listings. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah, and we couldn't
do it. That is insane.
We couldn't do it without you guys' support. Thanks very much. A big thank you from me and Matt. I think that's all we can say.
I think so. A special thank you to our Patreon supporters who,
of course,
you know, help us keep the mics on, buy books to research stuff, buy DVDs.
Travel expenses, travel shows and screenings. I mean, we've got some things coming up late in the next few weeks that we hope we can be sharing with you soon. New movies coming out. We're hoping to bring them to you first on Fighting on Film in review terms. We've got some very special guests lined up. So do keep a lookout on the socials and join us on wherever you can. And thanks very much. We'll catch you next week for another war movie review.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.